Thank you very much for your words and for your graciousness. And I would like to remind you all that you will, in fact, have a chance to ask questions. Please do write them down on the cards that you were given at registration, and they can be heartfelt and angry questions if you feel that way, and we will take them at the end. And I will remind you of that again. Our next speaker is Traji Mustafa. She is a Darfuri refugee living in Canada and a founding member of Save Women Sudan, based in Khartoum. She is also on the executive committee of the Darfur Association of Canada. While in exile, Ms. Mustafa has been actively involved in organizations working on racism, gender, and human rights. And tonight she will speak about the impact of violence on women and girls in Darfur, as well as on the international political response. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I prefer to speak standing too. Thank you very much for all people who organize this event. And thank you for all of you as a New Yorker citizen, as a very busy city, how you've managed to find time to come and listen about something about Darfur. For me as a Darfurian, we have really been touched deeply with a great activist from all over the world who work together to stop genocide in Darfur. For me, I came a long way as a Sudanese who have been brainwashed long time ago about what Christian, what Jewish will think about us as Muslims. But through working in this issue to stop genocide in Sudan, in Darfur special, I'm so proud to say that I came a long way. I learned a lot of knowledge inside me, and I'm very proud to say that I have a great friend from Jewish community, from Christian community, from Buddhist, from Sikh, from all over the world, near to my heart, more than Sudan government, more than a cousin who could be a Janjaweed now. Thank you very much for Canada and for the USA and for all the Western country who work together hardly to stop what is going on in Sudan. And with every single action any one of you gonna take from tonight and from what he did or she did last time, we're gonna stop this. So let us make a promise to all these orphans, to all those widows, to all those little girls who've been daily raped in Darfur now, that we're gonna stop this. I have a little quotation from Women United Nations report. The men in her community in South Darfur province say it would have been better for Fatma Adam, 15 years old, to have died than to have had Nashwa conceived out of rape, the child of an enemy fighter. This is a quotation. Three years later, after more than 800,000 lives have been taken in a cold blood in Rwanda, and after the world has said, never again, the horrible and the racist genocide of the 21st century burst out in Darfur. The international community has not yet taken the proper decision not only to stop the mass killing, rape, and other catastrophe that are still going on in Darfur, but also to make a necessary effort to realize justice and rehabilitate both the human and the environment in that part of the world. However, I'm not here today to speak about the more than 400,000 lives that have been lost so far in Darfur. For I am sure most of us here today have some knowledge about that in one way or another. I am also will not here to talk about the hundreds of villages which have been burned to the ground. Again, I'm not here to speak about the massive destruction of farmers and property. I'm here today to address the plight and dilemmas of my sister in Darfur, who have not only had their share of tragedy, like all the population of the region, but also that they have experienced the additional of physical and psychological aggression of mass rape and sexual humiliation. As a matter of fact, rape has become a battlefield within the entire warfare. Thousands of women and young girls have been repeatedly raped, in many cases by more than 10 men. Only few of these women have the courage to come forward and report their cases. Despite the fact that most reported indicate that the rape victims' age range in most cases between 12 to 45, there are cases of girls who have been raped whose age were 8 years old or less. These women and girls have experienced sexual humiliation during the raid of their villages, while they are taking care of their farms, herds, collection firewood, or when they are bringing water home. In addition, some of them are still prey for sexual assault while they are in the refugee camps, especially by the camp security, as some of them were ex-Janjaweed. Some of the rape victims have been held captive or even enslaved and regularly assaulted for a length period of time. Moreover, as the big cities in Darfur were filled with orphan children living in limbo, the information we get from there confirms that these kids have become target for sexual harassment and different forms of exploitation, including recruiting into the government militias. The rapists were the Janjaweed, Sudanese army, and recently we have heard the allegation of sexual assault committed by the very people the international community has appointed to protect them, AU troops. The dilemmas of the rape victims. The dominant social and cultural relation in Darfur stigmatized victims of rape as a thing which added more psychological and mental burden to their plight. As a result, there is a feeling of social and cultural isolation and hence lack of mental and psychological support. There are the boundaries of unwanted pregnancy. There are the feeling of guilt, sin, and uncleanness. Some of them were arrested by the police and punished for illegal pregnancy. Several reports also indicate that medical facilities to detect HIV or help affected women and girls are lacking, because agencies are overwhelmed by the nutritional emergency and difficulty in access, logistic, and capacity. The testimony present at the beginning of the speech can be taken as an example. What is to be done to help victims of rape? The immediate prevention of the appropriate medical treatment of the victim, the involvement of the entire Darfurian community in the different stages of healing and rehabilitation of the rape victim through the help of the community leaders, teachers, imam of mosque, medical employment, etc. Encouraging all victims of rape to come forward, speak of their nightmares and seek help. Regular visit to the victims of rape by professional trained women who would provide them with psychological support. Launching of a small income generating project to help these victims support themselves and gain their sense of self-dependency and self-esteem. We, however, believe that all these measures cannot be attained if our all efforts not decided towards attainment of comprehensive peace, which would facilitate the way for returning all the refugees to their secure villages. Comprehensive the victims of property, loss of damage, bringing to justice those who have committed war crime, including rape, of course, and crime against humanity. This is what we see as the only way to end the plight of Darfuri people in general and women in particular. I have little to add. Genocide for Darfurian continue outside of Sudan. Lately, if you hear about the massacre of Sudanese refugees in Cairo, who been attacked in December 30th, 2005, in front of the UN office, those people were just apply for political assignment, and nobody answered them. We believe that there's a great corruption in that office, Egyptian office. Those people were protesting for 3 months. Kofi Annan had made a visit to Cairo in that time. Those refugees, they take a risk and they run to him and they handed to him a letter which he have appeal of their cases. Why? They don't accept it as refugees and to be resettled somewhere out of Cairo. Because we believe Egyptian community, Egyptian government is working hand to hand with the Sudanese government. All our activists in Egypt have been disappeared, and we have cases reported about that. Unfortunately, nobody answered them. And they've been attacked with the Egyptian police, more than 20,000 police surrounding 3,000 refugees who are protesting there. And the total killed is 300. Unfortunately, a lot of them were children. So this is a genocide. And why they have been attacked? Because most of them are non-Arabs. Most of them were Southern and Darfurian. So do you think if we know about political assignment or people who need protection according to definition nowadays more than Darfurian? Why you don't see many Darfurians here as political refugees? Because they have been blocked through the UNHCR offices all over the world. Nobody accepted their cases. We have to ask for investigation. Ask for investigation about these refugees who are being killed with a cold, bloody handed in Egypt. We have Darfurians who are trapped in Iraq, where all the foreigners run out of Iraq. Other Sudanese, they run out. But Darfurians, they run to where? They have genocide go ahead in their region. The Jordanian government blocks the border in front of them. They said you have no right to enter Jordan, whether to Khartoum or you are not allowed to be political refugee in Jordan. And they have been there, and we reported this to many agencies and many organizations which work with human rights. So let us take the action. Let us stop human rights abuse in Darfur. Let us stop the violence against women, and let us stop the rape. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you very much. At this time, volunteers will be passing through the aisles to collect your questions. Please pass them to the aisles, if you would, and they'll be picked up, and we'll get as many of them as we can to the panel. Last but not least, our final speaker is Juan Mendez, who is the president of the International Center for Transitional Justice. He is also the UN Special Advisor for the Prevention of Genocide, and in that capacity, he has visited Darfur twice since 2004. Previously, he was also a member of the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights and its president in 2002. This evening, he will conclude our panel by addressing issues of accountability. And following his remarks, there'll be a short video presentation before we go to the Q&A. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. It is a real pleasure and an honor to be here invited by Amnesty International and by Human Rights First and by the New York Society for Ethical Culture. It's especially an honor to follow in those very eloquent remarks by my three panel members. And particularly, I want to commend all of you for being here, because by being here, you're already taking a stand to see what we all can do with some of the very helpful suggestions by the three previous speakers on what can be done to stop what's going on in Darfur. I have a prepared statement that I'm going to read quickly so that we have time for questions and answers. Since my appointment as special advisor in July of 2004, the situation in Darfur has been of primary concern for me. I visited Darfur at the Secretary General's request in September of 2004, together with Louise Arbour, the High Commissioner for Human Rights. Upon our return, Ms. Arbour and I briefed the Security Council and provided recommendations designed to enhance the protection of civilians and to prevent future violations of human rights and humanitarian law. Throughout 2005, I expressed my concern that our reaction to the situation in Darfur was both slow and hesitant. I stressed that in the short and long term, the prevention of genocide is predicated on acting comprehensively and decisively in four interrelated areas. First, the protection of populations at risk against serious or massive violations of their human rights or violations of international humanitarian law. And by this I mean, if necessary, armed protection, protection by armed contingents and police forces. Second, establishing accountability for those violations of human rights and international humanitarian law that have already taken place. Third, humanitarian relief to those who have already been victimized and are in dire need of support. And fourth, steps to address the underlying causes of conflict through peace agreements and reconciliation processes. Over the last 18 months, I have made several concrete proposals for action along these four areas to the Security Council and to the United Nations more generally. For the purposes of this panel, I have been asked to concentrate on those recommendations that relate to accountability and transitional justice. Accountability for violations is a key measure to prevent future offenses by ensuring that crimes already committed do not go unpunished. I therefore stressed early on the need to end impunity in Darfur. The High Commissioner for Human Rights and I made this the centerpiece of our joint briefing to the Security Council in early October 2004 upon a return from our first trip. In this respect, the Sudanese authorities at various stages over the past 2 years have announced steps with regards to accountability. From national commissions of inquiry, two of them supposedly designed to address rape, to naming a special prosecutor, to creating a special court for the crimes committed in Darfur. Nonetheless, impunity continues to prevail, and it feeds a deep sense of mistrust in the IDPs and vulnerable groups. Given the manifest unwillingness of the Sudanese authority to engage in a good faith effort to prosecute major crimes committed in the region, I advocated referral of the situation in Darfur to the International Criminal Court. The International Commission of Inquiry, set up by the Security Council in late 2004 and led by Professor Antonio Cassese, reached the same conclusion after a serious investigation of the evidence on the ground. A major milestone was achieved at the end of March 2005 with the Security Council's approval of Resolution 1593, which referred the situation in Darfur to the ICC and decided that the government shall cooperate fully with the court and with the prosecutor. The government of Sudan at various junctures has argued that the local courts have sufficient capacity and independence and that the referral by the Security Council is an interference with its sovereignty. We must recall, however, that the government has an obligation, not an option, to cooperate fully with the prosecutor of the ICC, as demanded by the Security Council in Resolution 1593. Furthermore, we must stress that without a significant measure of justice, we are unlikely to have any lasting peace in Darfur. While impunity reigns, the crimes committed by thugs and marauders with support from the government will continue to be blamed on the innocent members of the communities those people claim to represent. Cooperation with the ICC prosecution should be seen as a way to create an atmosphere conducive eventually to reconciliation. Under the principle of complementarity, the ICC will concentrate only on the perpetrators bearing the highest responsibility for war crimes and crimes against humanity, thereby supporting and not interfering with efforts of the Sudanese judiciary to bring justice to those crimes under domestic jurisdiction. At most, the ICC will be able to prosecute a handful of individuals. But domestic prosecutions must be conducted in good faith and with independence. In this regard, I must note that the cases that have been considered by the Special Court for Crimes Committed in Darfur do not deal with the major crimes committed during the peak of the campaign against villages of the so-called African tribes. They involve mainly low-ranking government officials and unknown civilians for cases that could have easily been tried in the ordinary justice system if there was a real sense that they should be tried. Other important transitional justice measures should include: first, measures designed to ensure that security forces in Darfur are professional and especially not compromised by complicity and involvement in crimes. Vetting of the police and other security forces in Darfur will be a necessary measure, particularly given the distrust that has been generated in the security forces. We have been dismayed at reports of the incorporation of Janjaweed militias in various government forces. After traveling to Darfur, I urged that the government of Sudan promptly set up a comprehensive plan for the full implementation of its obligation to disarm the Janjaweed, including all irregular paramilitary groups and individuals who may have been introduced into the popular defense forces, border intelligence guard, popular police, or nomadic police. Disarming the Janjaweed is a specific obligation imposed on the government of Sudan by the Security Council, and nothing has been done about it other than incorporating their members into the regular security forces. For disarmament to proceed, there will need to be a serious registration and vetting of all the security forces operating in Darfur with a clear purpose of excluding those known to have committed human rights violations. An inclusive, credible and grassroots process of intercommunal dialogue will be needed to re-establish peaceful intercommunal relations and to reweave the badly damaged social fabric of the region. Specific measures to address property and land usage rights, water rights, pasturing and cattle passage rights are indispensable to achieve peace and restore relations between nomadic herders and sedentary agriculturalist tribes. While much stock is being placed on a broad Darfur-Darfur dialogue that would follow an agreement in Abuja, I have stressed the need for prompt and credible intercommunal reconciliation efforts at the local level without waiting for results in Abuja to address the need for dialogue among groups that must live side by side. Those conversations should not wait until Abuja produces results, and they must be held under a credible sponsor, which incidentally rules out any Sudanese authority. Reparations will be an important measure to help bring lasting peace, marking a break with the conflict and offering a measure of compensation for victims whose lives have been ravaged. In this connection, I commend Physicians for Human Rights, our colleague human rights organization, for taking the lead in advocating for reparations in Darfur. The process will not be simple. Already discussions on this issue are reportedly proving to be a sticking point in the negotiations at Abuja. The experience of conflict between North and South Sudan and its aftermath paradoxically may create limitations with regard to the willingness of parties to agree to certain measures of transitional justice in Darfur. Thus, the SPLM, as a constituent element of Sudan's new government of national unity, may be unwilling to support proposals for significant reparations which were not afforded to victims of the North-South conflict. Lastly, a broader process of accounting for crimes in Darfur through truth-telling will undoubtedly be needed, particularly given the difficulties in settling the vast number of crimes committed and the inevitable impunity gap that will result even in the most optimistic scenario for prosecutions. We must be aware, however, of the risk of perpetuating impunity under the guise of reconciliation. We will need to take steps to make sure that any truth-telling exercise that may be undertaken does not close the door on possible legal measures of redress, including prosecutions in the future. Like most of you, I think it is premature to talk about comprehensive transitional justice mechanisms in Darfur, given the more pressing demands for protection of populations that are at serious risk of massive systematic violations of their most fundamental rights. However, I also believe that as we press on our leaders to step up to the responsibility to protect them, we also need to think creatively about what will it take, not just to preserve an unstable, precarious, and morally unacceptable status quo, but to offer long-term and sustainable solutions to Darfur's problems. Thank you.
Now we turn very importantly to your questions. The first question, I think, is one that has been addressed in part tonight, but there's much more to be said about it, and it is, what is the most effective way that we as American citizens can pressure the U.S. government and the U.N. to act in Darfur? And the questioner says, please be specific, with specific underlined. Would you like to start?
I think the key is simply political pressure. And after Rwanda, former Senator Paul Simon of Illinois said that if 100 people in every congressional district had written to their member of Congress and said, this can't go on, that would have been enough to change the political dynamic and there would have been intervention. I think the same is true today. Nobody is calling up the White House or a member of Congress and saying, we really shouldn't do anything about genocide. So there's no counterview to overcome. It's simply a matter of getting enough phone calls to the White House, letters to one's member of Congress, letters to the editor, enough public attention that then you do get the White House in particular to take action. So I think that's the place to start.
Any of the other speakers like to address that?
Well, with respect to the United Nations, something specific that can be done is realize that the bottleneck is at the Security Council and that we need to shame the Security Council and all its members into action. At this point, there's no proposals for action because, like in many other situations in the United Nations, we end up proposing that which we know we can get, but we are shy of proposing those things that we know are going to be difficult to obtain. And yet, a year ago, when we thought it wasn't going to be possible, we did get the Security Council to refer the case to the International Criminal Court. And that was under Chapter 7, without the consent of the Sudanese government. So it's not completely impossible to get Security Council action. But I think, quite frankly, the Security Council acts in a very shielded way because, like Nick says, there's not enough constituent pressure. And I realize, of course, that structurally the Security Council is difficult to lobby at, for action. But I think, quite frankly, that's where the bottleneck is, and that's where we need to put our pressure on.
Ms. Mustafa?
Besides asking our MBs in all the cities as American citizens, I think we have to take more action towards China. We have to organize protests in front of Chinese embassy all over the world. China is the one who sells weapons besides digging the oil inside Sudan, providing the money for this corrupt government to corrupt even the African Union's leaders, okay, the African troops. Okay? China is voting against anything in the Security Council to stop Sudan government, for example. So we have to organize protesting in front of Chinese government. We have to send a message that we will not buy any Chinese product if you don't stop support this criminal government in Sudan.
This is, in a way, a follow-up question, and it comes from a student from the Whitehead School who asks, which U.S. official in particular would be the best target of our lobbying?
It's essentially all about President Bush. There are other officials. Bob Zillick, the Deputy Secretary of State, has the door for a portfolio, along with Michael Gerson, also in the White House. But fundamentally, this is driven by President Bush. Congress matters essentially only in the degree to which it puts pressure in turn on the White House, and the kinds of things that need to be done need to come from the President himself.
Anyone else like to address that?
Well, and again, at the Security Council, of course, Ambassador Bolton. But I stress that we need to pressure all of the Security Council, not just one member.
I believe the American citizens have a very strong role. Let's work through all the party, Republican, Democrat, anyone who have membership. Let us ask our leader to take action now, and you can do it.
This question is in a way a follow-up to Ms. Mustafa's first answer, and an individual here asks, how can I disinvest as an individual? Is there a list of companies that are heavily invested in Sudan?
Mainly they are Chinese companies, if I get the question right, and Malaysian company, and some Indian company too. But mainly they are the Chinese. I'm not sure about the names. I'm sorry about that.
Would anyone else like to address that question?
It tends to be, as you say, Chinese companies. Some European, Siemens operates in Sudan. CNOOC, the Chinese petroleum company. Pension funds are more likely, and university endowments are more likely to own these kinds of shares than individuals. But simply the process, the divestment campaign, which has been gathering ground over the last year, including state funds, it seems to me that the principal benefit of that has been less the divestment itself and more the public attention that it has brought to this issue, and I think that is very important.
The next question is specifically to Nicholas Kristof, but any of the other speakers can comment as well. And here the questioner asks, what is your opinion on the New York Times acceptance of more than $2 million from the Sudanese government for a lengthy advertisement in the Sunday edition several weeks ago?
I was in Pakistan when that ad came out, and I was on my satellite phone, which is, 12,000 baud, and all of a sudden my emails, I was getting all these emails from people saying, how could you? And frankly, I was much less outraged than most of my friends. I had essentially two views. When I got back and I saw it, I kind of felt like I wanted to take a shower. It's blood money. It felt like it marred a newspaper that I love. But it also seemed to me, it seemed to me something that didn't hurt the people of Darfur itself. And it seemed to me that the principal thing one should be focusing on the media about is not accepting advertising that, it seems to me, isn't effective at all in improving Sudan's image, but rather pressure on the media to cover what is going on in Darfur, and that is the area, it seems to me, where the media have failed the most.
Would anyone else like to comment on that?
Sure, I didn't like it, but I think it's better than buying weapons and killing children. And I think it is evident for me to show that how these criminal leaders who control Sudan now are really smart. And to catch a smart and dangerous criminal, we have to be more smartest. Those people, they try even to clarify their names with the Western media. So you could imagine how they are. And it will let me lead you to another thing that, you remember after people took Saddam off, they find a group of dead bodies. But with Sudan government, you'll find no evidence because they get the experience from Saddam, so they use chemicals to finish even the bones, and you can imagine. And we have dead of flight who move dead body before Italian ferries, There was a committee organized by UN to go and investigate, and there was Italian president of that committee. They delay him in Khartoum. They said the weather is not good to go there and investigate while they are moving dead body. So you can imagine how this government is criminal. So it's just evident for me that how they are really ready to go to any limit to clarify their name.
Let me just remind you again, if you do have a question, please write it down on the card, and Denise, who's walking around, will collect your questions so you can hold them up. We may be able to get a few more in. Sticking with the media theme, another question for Mr. Kristof. This person writes, I work in the news media, and the line, as Mr. Brown stated, is that no one cares to watch or hear this story. What response do you get to your series from readers? Thank you.
It's true that, in general, writing about Darfur, you get much less of a response than you do if you write about something that seems nearer to people. If you write about gun control or abortion or President Bush, then you get tons of emails and responses. If you write about something so far away at Darfur, it does seem, it's something that people, I think, risk tuning out. I think, though, that the calculation is different for television, and it seems NBC did send a crew in. Ann Curry lobbied hard to do that, and they found that they had great ratings for that, and it's so visual that it seems to me television has just catastrophically miscalculated. But beyond the question of, you know, whether people watch it or not, you also know that at some point we will be looking back. We in the media will be looking back and knowing that we blew it. My newspaper, the New York Times, during the Holocaust, a study by Laura Leff showed that we published 24,000 front page stories. And of those 24,000, six referred in the front page part to attacks on Jews by the Nazis. The same thing, I'm afraid, when we're deeply shamed by that today, and I think we'll look back, particularly television, at coverage of Darfur and feel the same kind of shame and inadequacy.
Would anyone else like to comment on that question? We have two questions here, then, about genocide. The first question says, the Convention on Genocide of 1948 states that once the international community has acknowledged that it is indeed genocide, we, the international community, are both legally and morally obligated to intervene, yet we have not. How do you respond? Mr. Mendez, would you like to start with that one?
Yeah, the Genocide Convention of 1948 is, in fact, the source of my mandate, and my terms of reference refer me to it. The signatories to the Genocide Convention do pledge to take individual and collective action to prevent and to punish the crime of genocide. The convention is very old, and so it doesn't have it doesn't have very good mechanisms of implementation. So, in essence, it leaves it to the signatories to decide what constitutes prevention and what constitutes punishment. And that's the most disappointing aspect of the Genocide Convention. So much so that it lets important leaders of important countries off the hook by saying prevention is not defined. Therefore, you know, it really has to be decided on a case-by-case basis. I think, quite frankly, it's not only that it is a convention signed by 150 or so countries. In the 1950s, the International Court of Justice said that the obligation to prevent and the obligation to punish the crimes of genocide had acquired the status of jus cogens, that is, an imperative norm of international law that obliges all member states of the community of nations, and not only those that have signed and ratified that particular treaty. So there's no question that the obligation to prevent is not only a moral duty, it's a legal duty as far as I'm concerned as well. The main difficulty is precisely that because there's no mechanisms, at least not contemplated in the convention itself, there's been a whole disagreement over this 50 years or 60 years about what does prevention mean in the specific context of things like Darfur. And it has become basically an occasion for inaction, even in the face of the very clear legal and moral obligation. The creation of my office is a modest attempt to establish a mechanism by which, on a timely basis, matters can be brought to the attention of the multilateral decision-making bodies so that we can figure out what prevention means and how to implement it on a case-by-case basis. But as I've said, it's a modest contribution because it's an experiment, and because it's an experiment, we are operating on a trial and error basis.
Would any of the other speakers like to address this question? This question is, in a way, a follow-up, looking prospectively at the same issue. It comes from Waverly de Bruin from Global Action to Prevent War. Looking ahead for a moment to the next genocide that may break out, would you support the creation of a United Nations Emergency Peace Service that would be permanent, comprised of individual recruits, comprehensive, and serve as a first response to genocide? And I know that Global Action to Prevent War is working on just this very project.
Can I try? Thank you. Yeah, I've been participating in meetings with several of the groups that sponsor the UNEPS concept, the United Nations Emergency Protective Service, and I'm very excited about the prospects. I think everybody realizes that it would be a lot easier for the United Nations to be able to protect people from harm at the moment when harm is imminent if we didn't have to go around asking countries to provide forces, to provide money, etc. Unfortunately, we're down to that every time we need to deploy internationally. So the idea is to create a ready force that the political organs of the United Nations can deploy quickly and that will not be subject to political decisions adopted in 150 capitals around the world. But I also think that it shouldn't be only a military force. It should also be a civilian force that can quickly deploy peacemakers, peace enforcers, obviously, as well, but also specialists in reconciliation, in bringing people together, and particularly also providing humanitarian relief. A matter in which, fortunately, the international community has been much better at because of the existence of a variety of NGOs that are specialists on providing quick relief as needed. So in that aspect, I think we have done a lot better. But every time we are faced with a situation like Darfur, we realize how much more we need to do in the area of protection.
Can I just add that the need to provide protection and security is not just about resisting genocide. It's simply also about fighting poverty and helping poor countries. If you look around Africa, for example, those countries that have had the most difficulty tend to be those where security has fallen apart, even if genocide is not the issue. And it's also true that insecurity is incredibly infectious, that when you get insecurity around, say, the Great Lakes countries, that then spreads through the Congo, the former Zaire, and ends up leaving millions and millions of people with no livelihood and getting no help. The same thing then happened in West Africa, where you had problems in Liberia that then spread to Sierra Leone, to Ivory Coast, and now threatened Guinea. And now I'm afraid the same thing is happening with Darfur, spreading to Chad, and perhaps after that to Niger or Central African Republic. So, you know, one way in which we can help fight poverty and help the process of development is not just by building hospitals and building schools and providing mosquito nets, although we need to do all of that, but it's also in containing these outbreaks of violence before they can destabilize vast areas.
Ms. Mustafa, would you like to address this?
I think as Darfurian, sure, with all the pain I feel for others, but I speak differently from others. I speak while I have relatives there, friends, family. So I think the action of international community is still very slow comparing with all the evidence and the knowledge we have about the issue. Rwanda case were happening in the capital, in big city. They were somehow lucky, by the way, to have everything documented. Because Rwanda itself is a very small country. So the UN mission were able to see the killing in front of them. But you can't imagine how Darfur far away and how this government were able to commit a very bad crimes. Nobody ever expected in Sudanese culture that it will happen one day. It happened in Darfur. But still, I think we were lucky somehow. We were lucky to have immediate emails, information. We have cell phone. People from inside, they are calling us in New York, in Canada, anywhere, telling us. So we reported everything, but the action is still slow. It's very different for me to understand why it is so slow. If you remember, during USA election, Mr. Bush and John Kerry, during the competitions, everybody say it is genocide in Darfur. That time they are looking for what? African-American vote? Why they said genocide and they still let it so slow? So maybe, yeah, we think as a matter of race, are we cheap because we are black? We have to die with all this number? And you know, sometimes we may try to understand, we know USA have or Bush government have a lot of difficulties in Iraq, and it's very difficult issue for them to take a decision to involve somewhere else. But in same times, it make our Muslim and Arab journalists always tell us, oh, you see, because you are poor in Darfur, they will never come. They went to Iraq because of the oil. We think human people are more valuable than anything. USA have did a lot to finish the communist camp. Now they are the leader of the world. They have responsibility to find democracy in all these dictatorial. They have to finish this dictatorial leadership. We love democracy. We would love to live in harmony all over the world. And the Darfurians, they were just looking for their rights. So can you imagine after 3 years of reports, 3 years of seminars, we are looking for action. It is too much to wait more. And I may let you go tonight and think about these three questions. We need the UN troops now in Sudan, not tomorrow. So my question to all of you, if we don't send US troops to Darfur, where else in the world do you think is more needed? And if it is not now, then when? And if it is not by UN power, then how? Going to stop this genocide. Thank you.
Ms. Mustafa, this question is also to you. Is anyone addressing the cultural nightmare of the rejection of women victims of rape by their husbands, fathers, and brothers? If not, it's a second violation.
Pardon, can you repeat that again? Sorry.
Sure. Is anyone addressing the cultural nightmare of the rejection of the women victims of rape by their husbands, fathers, and brothers? If not, it's a second violation.
You mean in Sudan? Are they reported some cases?
I assume it doesn't say, but in Darfur.
You know, lately, I will tell you about my personal experience. I'm working now in Canada, in my city, Hamilton, with something called Sexual Assault Center. So I learn a lot of knowledge about what is sexual assault, according to Western definitions. But in Sudan, it is not like that. So it is not easy for any wife to report that she have been sexually assaulted by father or something like that. Is that the question?
By the
Janjaweed? Yes. I said that in my paper, if you remember. And we said, unfortunately, they recruit Janjaweed militia in the military. And now they are guarding the camps. So they are doing the same crime again. And they are the same group who have been sent to Tashad. You hear later about the coup, we know they are the same Janjaweed. Unfortunately, they are attacking even, they take the young guys to force them to join this military. So It is all over there. It became common way of behaving. We were lucky nowadays to have Mr. Saleh Mahmoud, a Darfurian lower activist. He's here in USA. And you can't imagine how sad the stories he's telling me. Mm-hmm. Anyway. Oh, yeah. Sorry. Yes. You do, the first quotation, you remember when I said? Yes. Yes, there is some husband
Let
who divorced
answer,
their wife in front of a community. When the case that they brought her, for example, saved after she had been raped, okay? And they said to her, go, I don't want you anymore. And this is why I think those women need economic help, because they left, they miss their male supporter. You know, traditionally, it's the men who care about the economy for the family. So those women are facing isolation. Some of they lost their father, for example, and brothers, and the husband say, I don't want you anymore because you have been raped. So yes, we have those cases. We have been women who nobody want to accept them, and they need help. Thank you.
I just wanted to add, I think you would agree that that is still a major problem, but it seems to me that it is somewhat less now than it was 2 or 3 years ago, paradoxically, because there has been so much rape. And it certainly strikes me that when I travel in the area, that now, traditionally, a lot of women were, after rape, were simply driven out and had to build their own hut and live by themselves, and that now they are much more likely to be accepted by the family still. The husband is much more likely to say, no, it's not my wife's fault. And that likewise, because of international pressure, the Sudanese government has backed down from some of the worst abuses, such as arresting women who got pregnant and charging them with zina, such as dragging them out of clinics when they reported to get help, dragging them out and locking them up in jail. Those kinds of things, there has been some improvement on. What there hasn't been any improvement on is any decline in the rapes themselves. As far as I can tell, they are going on completely unabated and very much as a matter of Sudanese government policy as one more way of terrorizing the population.
My experience is similar. I mean, in my two trips, I did talk to women who were brave enough to break this barrier and speak about their experience, mostly when they were together and mostly when they were speaking to women, especially the High Commissioner for Human Rights got direct testimony on a case that had happened, you know, days before. The problem continues to be, however, that the treatment by the Sudanese authorities still does not reflect the gravity of the crime and puts a lot of burden on the women to reenact and to be re-victimized by the whole process of denouncing the case itself. And the two commissions that I mentioned, one national and one created in South Darfur, have been a complete sham, a complete pretense of taking the matter seriously, when in fact they are designed basically to discourage women from coming forward and testifying.
Thank you very much. There are a few people in the audience who are going to make an announcement, I think, so if you would come up now, and while you're doing that, I will make a few more announcements. I was asked to remind you all, in closing, to please go to the rally in Washington, D.C. on April 30th. Go to savedarfur.org for more information. Please hand in the postcards that are in your program and take the actions listed in the program. Of course, sign those postcards. The City Council of New York City is scheduled to consider a resolution to support the rally to stop genocide in Darfur at its meeting next Wednesday, April 26th. Councilmember Brewer is the sponsor. Please call your council member to ask them to vote for this resolution. And one more announcement.
Hi, I'm sorry. I'm a student, and I go to NYU, and I know that this point was driven home, but I just like to say how really inspiring this is. We all, as fellow New Yorkers, have come together to New York as citizens of the world, and addressing this issue and our concern is phenomenal, and I thank you all for being here with us tonight. Just two announcements really quickly. One is on Friday, April 21st, you guys can get on the bus in New York City. This is an annual event. that allows activists to get together for a full day of human rights action and education. And for more information, you can go on the Amnesty website, Amnesty USA, that is. And the second thing is, tomorrow evening is the final event of a week-long campaign in order to raise awareness on this issue in college campuses in the greater New York City area. It's called One Week for Darfur. And if you guys are interested, the website is www.one-week.org. And tomorrow night, there's going to be a concert, a benefit concert, to raise money for AR's Darfur campaign. And it's going to feature celebrity guest host David Cross, and is also going to feature Saul Williams and Jean Grey. And 100% of the ticket proceeds are going to go to Amnesty's work in Darfur. And if sold out, it can raise $15,000 to $20,000. And I hope that you guys join us. And lastly, I'm just an ordinary girl, and you all are ordinary people, but I think that it's very apparent from tonight's events that we can all get together and do phenomenal and extraordinary things to end this. Thank you.
All I want to do now is to thank in particular the New York Society for Ethical Culture and Human Rights First, and all of the volunteers and organizers of this event, and especially our wonderful speakers this evening. We all have a lot of homework to do. This is the beginning.
This MP3 was made available online by the New York Sound Posse at newyorksoundposse.com.